This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Jason Schwartzman, is the star of the HBO comedy series Bored to Death. He got his first leading role while he was still in high school, playing a prep school student in Rushmore, which also starred Bill Murray. He worked with the director, Wes Anderson, on two subsequent films, The Darjeeling Limited and Fantastic Mr. Fox. He also co-starred in I Heart Huckabee's Funny People and Scott Pilgrim vs. the World. Although Schwartzman didn't plan to become an actor, he thought of himself as a musician. He's from a movie family. His mother, Talia Shire, played Adrian in the Rocky movies and Michael Corleone's sister, Connie, in the Godfather films, which were directed by Schwartzman's uncle, Francis Ford Coppola. In the HBO series Bored to Death, Schwartzman plays a pretty unsuccessful writer whose love life isn't any better. In pursuit of some adventure and money, he takes out an ad offering his services as a private eye. Unlicensed. He gets a lot more adventure than money out of it. In this scene from the opening episode of the current season, season two, he's starting a new job teaching a writer's workshop.
So here are my three rules of writing. One, it's difficult. Two, there will always be more rejection than acceptance. And three, try to give pleasure with every sentence.
But it's easy for you to say there will always be more rejection than acceptance. You're a published writer. You've already made it.
Well, actually, my second novel was just rejected. I have to pay back my advance to my publisher. It's pretty demoralizing.
The character Jason Schwartzman plays in Bored to Death is named Jonathan Ames, the same name as the writer who created the series. Schwartzman was already a fan of Ames's work when they first met a few years ago about a movie project Ames was developing. But when Ames brought up another project, which turned out to be Bored to Death, Schwartzman knew that was the one for him.
3 weeks before meeting him, I was talking with a friend of mine about how I felt a little bit adrift creatively. I had just come home from working on a film, and there are some actors, and I describe it as like they can just get a part like one could order a pizza. They just say, I want this, I want that, with that on it, and then 2 days later, they're shooting it. Other actors, you know, it is a bit harder of a process, and there's many different stages of it. So I was talking to my friend about how I just felt a little bit antsy and, you know, what does the future hold? And we were talking about stuff, and he said, well, if you could just have, like, your dream part, what would it be? And I said, my dream part. I guess it would be to play a private detective of some kind. Because I love Stolen Kisses, which is this movie by Francois Truffaut, and I love The Long Goodbye. And so now flash back to the present with Jonathan Ames. I say, so what is the story that you wrote about? What is this possible HBO show about? And he said, oh, it's about a writer who becomes a private detective. And I said, wow, that sounds great. And I said, wow, I'd love to read the short story of that. How is that possible? He said, well, it's in, you know, I'll email it to you. So I read it. I loved it. He emailed me the script. I read that. And I immediately just put it kind of all out there in an email to him, basically saying, if there's any way I could try to convince you or anybody that I would like to be a part of this, please let me, because I think that this is a part that I must play in. And then I go and I met with everyone at HBO, where I kind of described my take on the character and how I thought that I would portray it.
So how did you describe your take on the character of the, of the writer and unlicensed private eye that you play on Bored to Death?
Well, there were a couple points that I felt pretty strongly about. The main one being that I didn't think it should be a spoof. You know, I'm playing a character who is emulating a private detective. You know, it's kind of acting like one because he wants to. You know, I said, of course it will be tricky, but if I'm overtly too old school noir private detective, the clients who are hiring me won't believe me. You know, I said basically I shouldn't be a bumbling private detective, and nor was it written that way, by the way, but I wanted to really reinforce that, yes, it's a comedy, but I should try to be the best private detective I can be, especially when I'm meeting with clients about a case, because they need to believe that I can get the job done. So I said, yes, I won't be a great private detective or I will solve things in an unorthodox way, but I will always try to be the best private detective possible. So that was sort of the main thing. And the other thing I just said was I don't want him to be judgmental as a character, because what I love about Philip Marlowe is though he's a good guy, he kind of is respected by the bad guys. He's kind of like one of them. He drinks a lot. He's got troubles with women. He can be violent. And I like that he's moral, but also kind of tough. And so though my character wouldn't be to that extreme, I did want to have the character be, not judgmental and like a goody two-shoes type of person.
So even though you didn't want this to be a spoof, it's still funny. And you want your private detective to be trying hard, but he's still often inept. And he's certainly not two-fisted and not hard-boiled and not very good at handling pain. And to prove that point, I'm going to play a scene from this season of Bored to Death. This is a really funny scene. This is you go to an S&M dungeon to steal the hard drive of a dominatrix for a client who's a cop, and the cop's afraid that he's on her list and he's going to be blackmailed. So in a subsequent episode, two tough guys who used to own this S&M dungeon demand the hard drive back because there's all kinds of incriminating stuff on there. But you tell them you can't give it back because it was for a client. You don't have it anymore. You have no idea where it is. So you say you can't give it back. They basically kidnap you and demand that you give it back to them and then decide to basically hold you for ransom.
Yes.
So here are the tough guys trying to get the information out of you.
So who hired you?
I can't tell you. I won't tell you.
Let me make this simple for you. We're on the land. We need money. That hard drive was our IRA. Our retirement fund.
Yeah, jerk off. We had pictures. We had videos. We could have made a fortune. It was a blackmail gold mine.
Now all we have is you and whoever hired you. So you have a choice. Give us your client's name. Or we hurt you.
That's a terrible choice.
Ow! Charlie Horse, that is so cheap.
One more. Name.
Okay. His name's not gonna do you any good. He's a cop.
He knew there was gonna be a raid. You guys were laundering drug money. You're not gonna blackmail a cop.
He's right. Should we kill him?
What? Kill? No, no killing, no killing. I'll pay you. How much do you want?
Now you're talking. We want to open up a new dungeon in Boston. That's about 20 grand.
We only use the best equipment.
$20,000? That's impossible. You see, I'm also a writer. My second novel was just rejected. I have to pay back my advance. I teach at night to make ends meet.
I can't take this. Let's just kill him and get out of here. No, shut up. Do you have any rich friends?
Yes, I have one. But I don't think we should involve my friends.
Oh, 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 four!
I really like hitting you. You gonna call your rich friend?
No.
Okay.
Okay. But I just want you guys to acknowledge that I probably could have taken a few more punches. But because we're in a rush, I'll make the call now.
My guest, Jason Schwartzman, in a scene from Bored to Death, along with Dominic Lombardozzi, who used to be in The Wire, and Jim Norton as the tough guys from the S&M dungeon. So did it hurt when they were hitting you? How did you do that?
They were faking it on a lot of those hits. But there was there's a scene that precedes that scene where they're hanging me over a bridge, and they pull me back over a railing and they slap me. And because of the camera angle, it was impossible to fake it. And so they were really hitting me hard. And that hurt.
Your screams are very funny. I mean, I hate to laugh at somebody's pain, but
That. It's funny because when they first, like when Jonathan and I, you know, he's like first telling me about the show, and yeah, you're going to, you know, you can be breaking down doors and beating people up. And yes, I get to do that. But I do find more than not, I feel like I'm getting beat up and I'm getting chased more than I thought I would.
That is true. What's the funniest scrape that your character has gotten in?
Physically?
Yeah, or otherwise, romantically? There's plenty of those, too.
Gosh, there's so many. That episode right there is an example of what I like about the second season of the show, which is that the stakes kind of get higher. In the first season, I'm just starting out, and a lot of my cases are strange and kind of non-threatening. And as I'm going on, especially in this season, the stakes do get higher, and you know, this is an example of where I really could die And I like that about the show, that it's kind of, the troubles are getting a bit more harsh.
Now, in addition to starring in Bored to Death, you wrote and performed the theme song.
Yeah.
So how did you decide what kind of theme to write, like what it should sound like, what the lyrics should be?
This is an embarrassing story, and
great.
One that I feel I feel terrible about, because it will expose me as a kind of low-key liar. But I was talking to Jonathan about doing the theme song to the show, and I was totally flattered by the opportunity to try that, and I did tell HBO that I would like to submit the song with other songs and, you know, have it try to win the slot fair and square. And I was in Los Angeles, and I was finishing a film called Funny People that I was acting in, and it was taking up all of my days on the set. And I was supposed to be writing this song, and every week I would get an email from people at HBO saying, how's the song coming? And I would just kind of say, everything is great. Even though I had nothing written, I'd say, everything is great. And I would quickly, like, invent something that I had written and describe it. Like, it's great. I've come up with this walking bass line. I think it's very right for the song. And they'd write back, great, can't wait to hear it. Then a week later, how's it going? Very good. I've got some horn parts that I think are going to be really good. Another week. How's it going? Wonderful. I've got this piano thing. And basically, I lied for a month on the fly about what was in this song musically. Then it came time, really, for me to submit a demo. And to not seem like a liar, I went back through all of my sent emails and saw all of the things that I had said were in the song. I wrote them down, and then basically to fulfill the lie, I just wrote the song based on every fib I had emailed, and I wrote it in 10 minutes.
Okay, Mr. Liar, we will now listen to the theme song and go down the checklist.
Oh boy.
Of things
I'll
so that you lied that you said were in the song, and then you ended up having to put in. So we're listening for horns,
walking bass line,
piano. Anything else?
Yes. Sort of like noirish, kind of obscure lyrics, and that's it.
Okay. We got our checklist. Let's take a listen. This is the theme from Bored to Death, written and performed by my guest Jason Schwartzman.
All the shadows in the city. Used to love you, what a pity. I miss the questions you used to ask me. Bored to death, cut mad and lonely. Bored to death, cut mad and lonely. Bored to death, cut mad and lonely.
Wow, check, check, check,
all
and check.
Of the lies.
You got all of them in.
Also, it should be noted that I wrote the lyrics with Jonathan Ames. We got to collaborate together, and it always makes me happy. At the end of the show, a little credit appears that says, written by Jason Schwartzman and Jonathan Ames, and it was cool to collaborate with him on the lyrics.
You mentioned the reason why you were so distracted when you were supposed to be writing the theme for Bored to Death was because you were working on the movie Funny People, which is a movie. Mm-hmm. Directed and written by Judd Apatow. And I want to play a scene from the film, because in this film, you're living in a house with several comics, Jonah Hill, Seth Rogen, and you're the one who suddenly starts to make money because you're in this really terrible sitcom called Yo Teach. Mm-hmm. And you're trying to be like the real hip teacher. And I want to play a scene from the film in which you are sitting on the couch with a girl who's your neighbor, and you are really admiring yourself on TV. So this scene begins with the actual TV show. You're in front of the class, and you're all talking about rappers.
Kanye!
T.I.
Little
Weezy.
It's all about
Eminem.
But you guys know who the greatest rapper of all time is?
William Shakespeare.
I know it's silly, but it's fun. You know, people like it.
Yeah.
You know.
It's just cool that you're on TV. I mean,
I can't believe you haven't seen this before.
Yeah, I can't believe it's gotten by me.
She's great, Aubrey Plaza.
My guest is Jason Schwartzman. He stars in the HBO series Bored to Death, which is in its second season. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jason Schwartzman, and he stars in the HBO series Bored to Death. Now, you made this movie, Funny People, with Judd Apatow writing and directing. Mm-hmm. You've made several films with Wes Anderson. Your first film, Rushmore, in which you were a prep school student. The Darjeeling Limited, in which you were one of several brothers on the way to India to see your mother. And Fantastic Mr. Fox, the animated film, in which you were the son of Foxes, George Clooney and Meryl Streep. And it seems like by starting your career in Rushmore with Wes Anderson, that you managed to start your career with a young director who was probably a little older than you, but you were both getting started. I'm wondering if that was good for you. You know what I mean? If that really worked for you to start with somebody who was closer to being a peer. You were still in high school, right?
But, yes.
But he was still closer to being a peer than if you'd started with, say, Clint Eastwood in a movie.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, it's so strange because I did not think that I was going to be an actor or in film. At the time, I was a senior in high school. I was making an album with my band that I had been in since eighth grade. And I was so nervous when I went to audition for that film. I had never auditioned for anything before. I wasn't an actor. And I went into a room full of little professional actors, literally 20 kids, you know, and their moms are next to them. And they look like they've been doing this for a long time, and they feel very confident. And I was suffering from low self-esteem, as a lot of people just do in high school. And I just didn't think I should be there. I didn't know why I was there. And I was really nervous. And yes, I will say that when the door opened, when it was my turn to go in and audition, when I saw that Wes was young, there was something that just was released into my blood that felt like, who knows if I get the part, but this guy is nice and I could be friends with this guy. We talked for almost 20 minutes about a band called Weezer, about an album called Pinkerton. Then we talked about my shoes that I was wearing and where I got them. And he was not what I was expecting when I walked into the room. And then on set, he felt older than me. He was only 27, but I was 17. And, you know, that gap is pretty big, you know, those years. And we were friends. He really was the first person who treated me like an adult.
Did it help that he wasn't part of the circle that your family was in? In other words, he wasn't connected to The Godfather, which your mother co-starred in, your mother, mm-hmm. Talia Shire. He wasn't part of the Rocky contingent, which your mother co-starred in as, mm-hmm. Rocky's wife. It wasn't somebody who knew you well as Talia Shire's kid. Or Francis Ford Coppola's,
sure.
nephew. Even though I will say that the person who got you the audition against your will, because it's not like you wanted,
yeah.
it, was Davia Nelson, who our listeners might know as one of the Kitchen Sisters, who does know the Coppola family. But anyways, when you were in there, yeah. with you and Wes Anderson, there was no previous, mm-hmm. existing big connection.
It's funny because, like, even when you say, like, Talia Shire's son, that only kind of becomes part of the conversation once I became an actor and people were writing, like, an article or something about me. It becomes something to, you know, put in the article. But as a teenager, just going to high school, I mean, it's not really part of the conversation. And
it wasn't,
my mom,
your fellow classmates didn't know that your mother was Talia Shire, or is it they didn't care?
Who knows? I mean, it just wasn't part of the...
Were they the sons really and daughters wasn't. Of people more famous?
No, absolutely not. But and I'm not at all passing judgment on other actors, but there are other actors whose children did grow up on film sets because they were working a lot probably in the 80s and stuff, and, you know, their kids were around, and that's great. When my mom had us, it just so happened she didn't work as much. She wanted to be with us more, and so she did work. There were a couple of the Rocky films and a Godfather film that was made, you know, after we were born, but we weren't set kids by any means, and my mom loves movies and so much, but she really doesn't like Hollywood or the system or the business of it, and she keeps a huge distance from it. I wasn't really raised in a Hollywood-type way. We were just at home a lot, hanging out and doing normal stuff.
My guest, Jason Schwartzman, will be back in the second half of the show. He stars in the HBO comedy series Bored to Death. Here's some of his music from the soundtrack of Funny People. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Had a lot of things to say. Down a walk, sweet take before you go away. Close the door in case you stay. And I can't believe it's already tired.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jason Schwartzman. He stars as a writer and unlicensed private eye in the HBO comedy series Bored to Death. His movies include Rushmore, I Heart Huckabees, The Darjeeling Limited, and Fantastic Mr. Fox. Schwartzman's mother, Talia Shire, played Adrian, Rocky's wife, in the Rocky movies, and Connie Corleone in the Godfather films, which were directed by Schwartzman's uncle, Francis Ford Coppola. How old were you when you first saw The Godfather and saw your mother as Al Pacino's sister?
16.
And that would have been what year? How long was the movie out by then?
It was 1996.
It was out a while.
Yeah.
It's out a while. What took you so long to see it?
Not sure, really. I don't know. That's a good question. I don't have an answer, but the first time I saw it, there was an anniversary celebration for it, and I'm not sure if it was a new updated print of the film, but it was screened in San Francisco, and I was able to go to the screening with my mom. I didn't really think, oh, there's my mom or what. I was able to just see it as a film, and really, I was just so locked in on Al Pacino's performance.
So did you have a lot of questions for your mother after seeing the film?
No. Not really.
How could you not?
I don't know. I guess I just, I don't really talk about her work with her too much.
Uh-huh.
You know, once I started to act more, I think that's when I became more inquisitive. And it wasn't even really about her. It was, I feel terrible saying this, but it was stuff like, what was John Cassell like? You know, who's the actor in The Godfather. Yeah, and, well, you know, what was he like? And as I began to learn more about acting and study and stuff, you know, you ask questions like, you know, how did Al Pacino work? Or what was it like to be with Marlon Brando? And she would recount stories to me. And but no, after I first saw it the first time there on the big screen, I was just kind of blown away by it as a film.
Was your mother surprised that you went into acting? Because she more or less gave up acting except to continue the Rocky and the Godfather series. And you didn't intend to go into acting until you were spotted and asked to audition, and you felt insecure going in, but you ended up getting the part in Rushmore. So when you, at the age of 17, ended up mm-hmm. starring in a very successful film,
mm-hmm.
who was more surprised, you or your mother?
Well, probably me. But when you're raised in L.A. and there are a lot of kid actors around, and no fault to them or to whatever, but, you know, for instance, I would get my hair cut in this barbershop in the Valley, and the woman who cut my hair had pictures of all the kids' hair she cut, kind of like rimming her mirror in front of me, and they were headshots of little kids dressed as cowboys or astronauts, you know, like showing what they could do, like the looks they could. And I would look at those kids while I would get my hair cut and just kind of stare at them, and I would think to myself, they just are different than me. They have something that I don't have. It's like a killer instinct or a confidence. So when I auditioned for Rushmore and then I got called back three times and there were less and less other kids up to go up against in the room. And yeah, when I got it, I was shocked because I felt like, wow, these other kids are like pros at this. And how, you know, how did this happen? And then when the film came out and people saw it, I was definitely shocked, but I was thrilled because in that time, I had fallen in love with movies in a way that I hadn't known before, and that really is because of two things. When I read the script of Rushmore, I loved it. It was everything I had ever found funny, and I could totally relate to the character. And I gave the script to my mom, and I said, Mom, I've never auditioned. Do you have any pointers? Can you help me memorize lines? And she read the script, and she said, I'll be right back. And she went out, and she rented three films. They were The Graduate, Dog Day Afternoon, and Harold and Maude. And I watched them all for the first time. They were films I had heard of but never seen, and it was in that moment, watching the films, I felt this like warm, insane feeling inside of my body, which was a feeling that only up until then music had given me. And it was in that moment where I said, gosh, you know, I don't know if I'll ever get this part. I don't know if my band will ever make it. But I've got to try to live my life somehow staying as close to this weird feeling as possible. Then meeting Wes, who is a film fanatic and lover of films, when we were making Rushmore at night in his hotel room, he was showing me all these great movies. And it was turning me on. It was a thrill to see all these performances. And I did fall in love with movies during the making of Rushmore.
What did he show you?
It was really nice. Oh, we watched all of the François Truffaut films, Jean-Luc Godard movies, you know, Martin Scorsese movies, lots of 70s American movies, and a lot of the French New Wave movies. And it really was like, I mean, just imagine your mind just like exploding, like bam, bam, bam. I was just so, it was an exciting time for me.
So we talked a little bit about the first time you saw your mother in The Godfather. What about Rocky? How old were you when you first saw Rocky?
Much, much younger. I don't know the exact age, but I saw Rocky III first. And it was weird. It was not a comfortable experience for me to see my mom, especially in that one, because Mr. T, such a weird like thing to be saying, like Mr. T says something kind of sexual towards my mother, like, let me take you home, I'll show you a real man or something. And I was young, and it made me feel very weird, and I did not like that Mr. T said that to my mom. Then in that same movie, I think like my mom's character and Rocky get in a fight on the beach, and they were yelling, and I didn't like that. It just was a highly uncomfortable experience anytime she was on the screen. But I love the movie. I mean, I loved Rocky, and I love the character of Rocky. And I will say, too, like, my mom didn't work a lot when we were growing up. But I was always taken aback by, you know, if we'd go see a movie or something, and someone would walk up to her and say, hey, you're Adrian. And she'd say, yes. And they would smile. And they seemed so happy. And as a little kid, I observed that. And she was always very, like, shy about it. Yes, you know, yeah, and she would kind of walk on, or I don't think she liked the attention. But for me, I was kind of like, wow, it's amazing that my mom did something that made all these people so happy, because when they see her, they smile, and they're so excited to see her. And I didn't understand why she was so embarrassed. But I think that had an effect on me, like how your work could maybe make people happy.
So how has that experience affected how you react when someone comes up to you on the street and they mention a movie or your TV show and tell you how much they like you?
First off, I'll note that I don't really get stopped or recognized that often. I walk everywhere and do everything, and no one ever really says anything. But when someone does, I can't tell you how much it really does mean to me. You know, with a band, you make a record, but then you go out and you perform it, and you're with an audience live, and you're experiencing it together. But with film acting, you make a movie and then a year later it comes out. And so you're not really, a lot of actors don't really interact ever with people who might have seen their work, and you never really know what the response is. And so to me, if someone comes up and says, that movie really, I like that movie, or that was really funny, it's a nice feeling because you feel like, oh, good, like someone out there saw it and, you know, it entertained them or amused them. And so it really does mean a lot to me. But I will say, when right after Rushmore came out, I'd never been like recognized, and this person came up and said, hey, you're from Rushmore, I love that movie. And I was so flattered and blown away by it that I went to hug her, and she recoiled. And she walked away, and I guess like I had overshot it a little bit.
That's funny. So, yeah. You mentioned your mother screened films for you, that Wes Anderson, when you were making Rushmore with him, mm-hmm. screened films for you. Did your uncle Francis Ford Coppola screen movies for you?
Yeah. Well, my mom, I'll just say really quickly, I love her because, people will ask me, like, did your mom encourage you to be an actor, or were you forced into it? And the truth is, no. But at a young age, what I really did witness, because she never forced it upon us, but I witnessed how movies and music can be nutritional, I guess, to a person. I would come home from school. She would always be downstairs with an old movie on. Every room in our house had a different book open, face down. There would be music on in one room, even though she wouldn't be in it. And she would kind of just go from room to room and pick up and read and go and listen and go downstairs and watch. She needs that. It's still the same way. If you go to my house, the same house I grew up in, she's there with movies on, music playing, and books everywhere. And so I witnessed how important these things can be to you. My uncle, Francis, I never really talked to him a lot about movies and stuff until I, became involved in the industry myself. I would ask him, but it is strange. The more I talk, I hear myself saying that I never asked them anything, and it's strange, but it is true. I never really asked my mom, my uncle, or my cousins about any of their own work. Maybe just because I don't want to be annoying. I mean, it is on my mind because I love the movie The Conversation that he made, and I do have lots of questions for him about that film, but I don't ask him because I suppose I just kind of think, man, he gets probably asked about it all the time, so, we're here together, this is his personal time, and it's maybe the last thing he wants to talk about. So I don't take advantage of his knowledge or my mom's or my cousin's knowledge, unless they bring it up. And so my uncle would show movies at his house, and I was there for some of them. They would be that I remember Yellow Submarine, Prick Up Your Ears, and I remember he showed a film called Vampire's Kiss that my cousin Nicholas was in. I saw that at a young age. That was a big thing for me. I loved his performance, and even though, like I say, I wasn't an actor, once we got the film on VHS, I would watch it over and over again, and I would rewind it, and I would just rewind certain scenes, and I would play them, pause them, and then try to mimic him, and then rewind it, play it again, and try to mimic him until I could do his voice and knew the lines by heart.
How old were you?
I don't know what year that film came out.
It was before you started
seven
acting.
Or eight.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, seven or eight.
Plays a vampire, and his performance is very much inspired by the drama of silent films, like of the silent
totally.
Nosferatu. Eats a cockroach
totally.
In it.
Yeah, I know. It's so, I mean, I was like, wow, who is this person that I'm supposedly related to?
Right. Unrecognizable
he was very mysterious.
In the movie?
Yeah, just a really wild person. And, I'll just say something else that just occurred to me. I recently found a bunch of home movies that my dad had shot, and in one of them he's filming the house, kind of saying, this is where Jason sleeps, and this is, and he walks into a room, and I'm sitting there watching the movie Amadeus by myself, and I'm so little, or maybe my t-shirt is so big, but I'm completely inside of the t-shirt, 2 feet from the screen watching Amadeus. And I do remember that movie being a big one for me, because Tom Holtz plays Amadeus, and I remember thinking, wow, Mozart was just like us. He was fun. He laughed. I was really loved that movie. And of course, I got to work this season in Bored to Death with F. Murray Abraham. He shows up later in the season. And that was a big one for me.
My guest is Jason Schwartzman. He stars in the HBO series Bored to Death, which is in its second season. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jason Schwartzman. He stars in the HBO comedy series Bored to Death as a writer and unlicensed private eye. His films include Rushmore, The Darjeeling Limited, and Fantastic Mr. Fox, which were all directed by Wes Anderson, and I, Heart Huckabees, which was directed by David O. Russell. How do you like being in a regular TV series? You know, being the star of a TV series.
Yeah, I love it because if you think about it, doing 8 shows, you really are doing 2 movies or 2.5 movies. And so you have kind of more freedom. And in a lot of ways, I think our show is cool because it's kind of the stuff that would be like cut out of other shows or be omitted from films. It's almost like the spaces between the spaces, our show, and I love that about it. I love that we can just kind of go make 8 strange, absurd movies, mini-movies, as opposed to 1 big movie. And the other great thing I love about doing television is I've never worked before on anything where you come back and you're playing the same character with the same crew and the same group of other actors. I've worked with directors repeatedly, and I've worked with different crew members, but never the exact same arrangement of elements. And I gotta say, it's so fun. I didn't know. I've never done a season 2 of anything, and when I showed up the first day of season 2, it was so fun because, and this sounds terrible, but acting for me is extremely embarrassing, and especially when you're doing it in front of all these strangers, you know, and you know, it's just like, oh God, they're going to judge me. They're going to think I'm terrible. But, well, now they've judged me. They've seen me at my worst. And now we've come back for season 2. You have nothing to be ashamed of. And it's like a family. And you can just get going.
Why is that thing embarrassing for you?
It's scary, I think. There is always something, maybe in the back of my mind, that says, I'm going to walk onto this set for the first couple days and people are going to be thinking, we made a mistake. We should find someone else. And
Can I stop you right there? Because
sure.
I can see one of the reasons why it might have. I mean, I read this, that when you were making Rushmore, your first movie, early mm-hmm. on in the filming, Bill Murray, your co-star, said to you, they promised me you'd be good, and you're not.
Yeah, that's true.
So maybe you're always waiting for the person to tell you that, because that's how it started.
Perhaps, and I think also if you did have a high school experience, I mean, there were many scarring encounters with girls and stuff where it was just like, or big groups of people laughing at me because I fell and tripped in front of 40 people. You know what I mean? Like those typical experiences. But I'll say something that I love about acting in film, and it's something that a lot of actors maybe don't like, but I love it, which is that it is a medium where we're going to like microscopically focus on this scene or this moment. And you can go back and get that one line just right or that word sounded strange. You know what I mean? Like,
mm-hmm.
And that's what I like about acting is I guess that I have a lot of ideas when I'm on the set and it's fun for me. And I feel like, why not just try it and mess around? But when you're messing around, the only way to know if it's going to work is to try. And I did this movie, I Heart Huckabees, with Dustin Hoffman, who was, of course, an icon and an idol to me. And on the first day of work, David O. Russell came up to me. I had a scene with Dustin Hoffman, and David O. Russell came up to me and whispered in my ear, say this line to him, you know, surprise him. And I did it, and he reacted, and they ended up using that, his reaction. But later that day, I felt so strange, you know, like springing that on this guy that I admire. And I walked up to his trailer, I knocked, and I went in, and I said, Mr. Hoffman, I just want to apologize if I was unprofessional or if I shocked you in any way. I didn't want it to come across like I was messing with you. And he said, are you kidding me? A take is the one place in life you can fail.
So what did David O. Russell tell you to whisper in Dustin Hoffman's ear?
I don't even remember. It was some line where I think I said you're lying. Like he says something to me and I say I don't believe you. Which is such a complicated thing to say to a hero of yours on so many levels. Your character saying it to someone is pretty, you know, is interesting. But to just, it, even though it's a line, just like the energy of like challenging someone who's like this guy I admire, and he's not,
he's not scripted. He's not prepared for it.
Yeah, it's totally like, it was scary. But I loved being a part of that film, and David O. Russell is one of the best filmmakers alive, and there's just some people you go with.
So yeah. I understand you have a baby who's due in December?
Yes.
And
it's crazy.
You're excited?
I'm excited. It's totally amazing to me because when I grew up, my dad was a little bit older when he had me, and so he had like a big white beard and was a lawyer, and I don't know, he was just like a man. You know what I mean? It felt like I had a man father. He was like, the circuit's blown. I'm going down with the flashlight to fix it. You know what I mean? Like, just kind of could get things done. And I still feel like very much kind of like still asking a lot of questions. And so, but I'm excited to see how that plays out as I become a father, because I hope to just be honest and I might not know where the circuit breaker is, but maybe the kid and I will find out together, you know?
Congratulations.
Thanks.
And, good luck with fatherhood. And yeah. It was a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, and thanks for your questions.
Jason Schwartzman stars in the HBO comedy series Bored to Death, which is shown Sunday nights. He co-stars in the movie Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, which is coming out on DVD November 9th. This is Fresh Air. The Israeli writer and peace activist David Grossman first achieved fame in the late 1980s for The Yellow Wind, a nonfiction book about the life of Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Since then, he's become internationally acclaimed for a series of novels, including Sea Under Love and The Book of Intimate Grammar. His latest novel, To the End of the Land, was written under the shadow of personal tragedy. And our critic at large, John Power, says it's a great novel about the invasion of private life by public history.
It's part of our national ethos that most Americans see themselves as free, self-defining individuals. In many other countries, that's impossible to do. You see, history is constantly rubbing up against you. Nowhere is that truer than in the Holy Land. I was reminded of this as I read To the End of the Land, the latest novel by David Grossman, the brilliant Israeli writer and activist who some call the conscience of his country. An honorific I sure don't envy him. I have enough trouble being the conscience of myself without having to do the job for millions of other people. That said, To the End of the Land is a novel that, among many other things, is about conscience. Its heroine is Ora, a gray-haired mother of two, recently separated from her husband. When her beloved son Ofer goes off on a military operation, Ora is terrified for his life. But rather than wait for the so-called notifiers to show up at her door with horrible news, she leaves Jerusalem. This is at once a form of magical thinking. If she's not there to get the bad news, then Ofer won't be hurt, and a way of refusing to be part of the war-making process. And so Ora hikes for days in the hills of Galilee along with her former lover Avram, from whom she's been estranged for decades. As the two climb between terebinth trees and placards devoted to those killed in Israel's wars, Ora tells her life story. We learn all about her and her husband Ilan, their two sons Ofer and Adam, and the family life they built. Along the way, we also learn what happened during the Yom Kippur War that turned Avram, once a sprightly source of exuberant artistry, into a quiet man who's retreated from the world. Grossman began working on this book when his son Yuri was in the army, and he hoped that writing it would somehow protect him. It didn't. Yuri and his tank mates were killed by a rocket in southern Lebanon. Naturally, this gives To the End of the Land a moving resonance. But Grossman would be the first to say that this doesn't guarantee its literary merit or give it any special moral authority on questions of war and peace. If the book was only about Ora fearing for her son, it would be just another boringly well-meaning anti-war novel. In fact, it's much, much more. For starters, Ora's story is about living in a country defined by what's known simply as the situation, the daily pressure of Middle Eastern history with its hatred and pettiness and killing. The book's original Hebrew title is A Woman Flees News, and the point is that Israelis can't really flee it and remain Israelis. And this exacts all sorts of costs on everyone, Jews and Arabs alike. Ora isn't simply worried that Ofer will be killed, but that in the ugly process of fighting the nation's battles, he will turn into someone she can't approve of, a hyper-masculine thug. She wants him and Israel to have a clear conscience. Then again, if To the End of the Land were only about the soul of Israel, it would feel abstract, unemotional. Instead, it's enormously powerful. Grossman has a feel for the fury and mire of domestic life, for the thrilling sound of the individual human voice. I've read few novels that capture so well the adventure of raising kids. Grossman has always been drawn to the magic of childhood, and to the way that men's bantering conversation can close out women, even a mother who loves them. At the center of all this stands the unforgettable figure of Ora, a woman at once nurturing and exhausting, sensual and deeply moral, boundlessly garrulous and not a little secretive, a life force and a real piece of work. As both a devoted mother of two sons and a loyal daughter of Israel, she yearns to be free of the moral and physical threats that are the very air she must breathe. But like Grossman, she knows there's no escape from history, let alone what lies beneath it, the terrible fragility of families and nations and all we hold dear.
Joan Powers is film critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. You can read an excerpt of David Grossman's new novel, To the End of the Land, on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, Lauren Krenzel, and Heidi Simon. I'm Terry Gross.